Chapter 47. The thoughts of worldly men are forever regulated by a moral law of gravitation, which, like the physical one, holds them down to earth. The bright glory of day, and the silent wonders of a starlit night, appeal to their minds in vain. There are no signs in the sun, or in the moon, or in the stars, for their reading. They are like some wise men, who, learning to know each planet by its Latin name, have quite forgotten such small heavenly constellations as charity, forbearance, universal love, and mercy, although they shine by night and day so brightly that the blind may see them, and who, looking upward at the spangled sky, see nothing there but the reflection of their own great wisdom and book learning. It is curious to imagine these people of the world, busy in thought, turning their eyes towards the countless spheres that shine above us, and making them reflect the only images their minds contain. The man who lives but in the breath of princes has nothing his sight but stars for courtiers' breasts. The envious man beholds his neighbor's honors even in the sky. To the money hoarder and the mass of worldly folk, the whole great universe above glitters with sterling coin fresh from the mint, stamped with the sovereign's head, coming always between them and heaven, turn where they may. So do the shadows of our own desires stand between us and our better angels, and thus their brightness is eclipsed. Everything was fresh and gay, as though the world were but that morning made, when Mr. Chester rode at a tranquil pace along the forest road. Though early in the season, it was warm and genial weather, the trees were budding in two leaf, the hedges and the grass were green, the air was musical with songs of birds, and high above them all the lark poured out her richest melody. In shady spots, the morning dew sparkled on each young leaf and blade of grass, and where the sun was shining, some diamond drops yet glistened brightly, as in unwillingness to leave so fair a world, and have such brief existence. Even the light wind, whose rustling was as gentle to the ear as softly falling water, had its hope and promise, and, leaving a pleasant fragrance in its track as it went fluttering by, whispered of its intercourse with summer, and of his happy coming. The solitary rider went glancing on among the trees, from sunlight into shade and back again, at the same even pace looking about him, certainly, from time to time, but with no greater thought of the day, or the scene through which he moved, than that he was fortunate, being choicely dressed, to have such favorable weather. He smiled very complacently at such times, but rather as if he were satisfied with himself than with anything else. And so went riding on, upon his chestnut cob, as pleasant to look upon as his own horse, and probably far less sensitive to the many cheerful influences by which he was surrounded. In the course of time, the maypole's massive chimneys rose upon his view. But he quickened not his pace one jot, and with the same cool gravity rode up to the tavern porch. John Willet, who was toasting his red face before a great fire in the bar, and who, with surpassing foresight and quickness of apprehension, had been thinking, as he looked at the blue sky, that if that state of things lasted much longer, it might ultimately become necessary to leave off fires and throw the windows open, issued forth to hold his stirrup, calling lustily for Hugh. "Oh, you're here, are you, sir?" said John, rather surprised by the quickness with which he appeared. "Take this here valuable animal into the stable, and have more than particular care of him, if you want to keep your place. A mortal lazy fellow, sir, he needs a deal of looking after." "But you have a son," returned Mr. Chester, giving his bridle to Hugh as he dismounted, and acknowledging his salute by a careless motion of his hand towards his hat. "Why don't you make him useful?"
"Why, the truth is, sir," replied John with great importance, "that my son what, you're a listening are you, villain?"
"Who's listening?"
returned Hugh angrily.
"A treat, indeed, to hear you speak. Would you have me take him until he's cool?"
apostrophe, walk him up and down further off then, sir, apostrophe, cried old John, and when you see me, and a noble gentleman entertaining ourselves with talk, keep your distance. If you don't know your distance, sir, apostrophe, added Mr. Willet, after an enormously long pause, during which he fixed his great dull eyes on Hugh, and waited with exemplary patience for any little property in the way of ideas that might come to him, we'll find a way to teach you, pretty soon. Apostrophe, Hugh shrugged his shoulders scornfully, and in his reckless swaggering way, crossed to the other side of the little green, and there, with the bridle slung loosely over his shoulder, led the horse to and fro, glancing at his master every now and then from under his bushy eyebrows, with as sinister an aspect as one would desire to see. Mr. Chester, who, without appearing to do so, had eyed him attentively during this brief dispute, stepped into the porch, and turning abruptly to Mr. Willet, said, "You keep strange servants, John." Apostrophe, strange enough to look at, sir, certainly, apostrophe, answered the host, "but out of doors, for horses, dogs, and the likes of that, there ain't a better man in England than is that Maypole Hugh yonder. He ain't fit for indoors," apostrophe, added Mr. Willet, with the confidential air of a man who felt his own superior nature. "I do that. But if that chap had only a little imagination, sir, apostrophe, he's an active fellow now, I dare swear," apostrophe, said Mr. Chester, in a musing tone, which seemed to suggest that he would have said the same but there been nobody to hear him. "Active, sir?" apostrophe, apostrophe, retorted John, with quite an expression in his face. "That chap. Hallo there. You, sir. Bring that horse here, and go and hang my wig on the weathercock, to show this gentleman whether you're one of the lively sort or not." Apostrophe, Hugh made no answer, but throwing the bridle to his master, and snatching his wig from his head, in a manner so unceremonious and hasty, that the action discomposed Mr. Willet not a little, though performed at his own special desire, climbed nimbly to the very summit of the maypole before the house, and hanging the wig upon the weathercock, sent it twirling round like a roasting jack. Having achieved this performance, he cast it on the ground, and sliding down the pole with inconceivable rapidity, alighted on his feet, almost as soon as it had touched the earth. "There, sir," apostrophe, said John, relapsing into his usual stolid state, "you won't see that at many houses, besides the maypole, where there's good accommodation for man and beast, nor that neither, though that with him is nothing." Apostrophe, this last remark bore reference to his vaulting on horseback, as upon Mr. Chester's first visit, and quickly disappearing by the stable gate. "That with him is nothing," apostrophe, repeated Mr. Willet, brushing his wig with his wrist, and inwardly resolving to distribute a small charge for dust and damage to that article of dress, through the various items of his guest's bill, "he'll get out of amist any winder in the house. There never was such a chap for flinging himself about, and never hurting his bones. It's my opinion, sir, that it's pretty nearly allowing to his not having any imagination, and that if imagination could be, which it can't, knocked into him, he'd never be able to do it any more. But we was a-talking, sir, about my son." Apostrophe, true, Willet, true, apostrophe, said his visitor, turning again towards the landlord with his accustomed serenity of face. "My good friend, what about him?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, it has been reported that Mr. Willet, previously to making answer, winked. But as he was never known to be guilty of such lightness of conduct either before or afterwards, this may be looked upon as a malicious invention of his enemies, founded, perhaps, upon the undisputed circumstance of his taking his guest by the third breast button of his coat, counting downwards from the chin, and pouring his reply into his ear. "Sir," apostrophe, whispered John, with dignity, "I know my duty. We want no love-making here, sir, and beckoning to parents. I respect a certain young gentleman, taking him in the light of a young gentleman. I respect a certain young lady, taking her in the light of a young lady. but of the two as a couple, I have no knowledge, sir, none whatever. My son, sir, is upon his patrol. Apostrophe, I thought I saw him looking through the corner window but this moment, apostrophe said Mr. Chester, who naturally thought that being on patrol implied walking about somewhere. No doubt you did, sir, apostrophe returned John. He is upon his patrol of honor, sir, not to leave the premises. Me and some friends of mine, that use the maple of an evening, sir, considered what was best to be done with him, to prevent his doing anything unpleasant in opposing your desires, and we've put him on his patrol. And what's more, sir, he won't be off his patrol for a pretty long time to come, I can tell you that. Apostrophe, when he had communicated this bright idea, which had its origin in the perusal by the village cronies of a newspaper, containing, among other matters, an account of how some officer pending the sentence of some court-martial had been enlarged on parole, Mr. Willett drew back from his guest's ear, and without any visible alteration of feature, chuckled thrice audibly. This nearest approach to a laugh in which he ever indulged, and that but seldom and only on extreme occasions, never even curled his lip, or affected the smallest change in no, not so much as a slight wagging of his great, fat, double chin, which at these times, as at all others, remained a perfect desert in the broad map of his face, one changeless, dull, tremendous blank. Lest it should be matter of surprise to any, that Mr. Willett adopted this bold course in opposition to one whom he had often entertained, and who had always paid his way at the Maypole gallantly, it may be remarked, that it was his very penetration and sagacity in this respect, which occasioned him to indulge in those unusual demonstrations of jocularity, just now recorded. For Mr. Willett, after carefully balancing father and son in his mental scales, had arrived at the distinct conclusion that the old gentleman was a better sort of a customer than the young one. Throwing his landlord into the same scale, which was already turned by this consideration, and heaping upon him, again, his strong desires to run counter to the unfortunate Joe, and his opposition as a general principle to all matters of love and matrimony, it went down to the very ground straightway, and sent the light cause of the younger gentleman flying upwards to the ceiling. Mr. Chester was not the kind of man to be by any means dim-sighted to Mr. Willett's motives, but he thanked him as graciously as if he had been one of the most disinterested martyrs that ever shone on earth, and leaving him, with many complimentary reliances on his great taste and judgment, to prepare whatever dinner he might deem most fitting the occasion, bent his steps towards the warren. Dressed with more than his usual elegance, assuming a gracefulness of manner, which, though it was the result of long study, sat easily upon him, and became him well, composing his features into their most serene and prepossessing expression, and setting in short that guard upon himself, at every point, which denoted that he attached no slight importance to the impression he was about to make, he entered the bounds of Miss Haredale's usual walk. He had not gone far, or looked about him long, when he descried coming towards him a female figure. A glimpse of the form and dress as she crossed a little wooden bridge which lay between them satisfied him that he had found her whom he desired to see. He threw himself in her way, and a very few paces brought them close together. He raised his hat from his head, and yielding the path, suffered her to pass him. Then, as if the idea had but that moment occurred to him, he turned hastily back and said in an agitated voice, "I beg pardon, do I address Miss Haredale?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, she stopped in some confusion at being so unexpectedly accosted by a stranger, and answered yes. Apostrophe, something told me, apostrophe, he said, looking a compliment to her beauty, that it could be no other. Miss Haredale, I bear a name which is not unknown to you, which it is a pride, and yet a pain to me to know, sounds pleasantly in your ears. I am a man advanced in life, as you see. I am the father of him whom you honor, and distinguish above all other men. May I, for weighty reasons which fill me with distress, beg but a minute's conversation with you here? who that was inexperienced in deceit, and had a frank and youthful heart, could doubt the speaker's truth, could doubt it too, when the voice that spoke was like the faint echo of one she knew so well, and so much loved to hear? She inclined her head, and stopping, cast her eyes upon the ground. A little more apart among these trees. It is an old man's hand, Miss Airedale, an honest one, believe me. She put hers in it as he said these words, and suffered him to lead her to a neighboring seat. You alarm me, sir, she said in a low voice. You are not the bearer of any ill news, I hope?
Of none that you anticipate, he answered, sitting down beside her. Edward is well, quite well. It is of him I wish to speak, certainly, but I have no misfortune to communicate.
She bowed her head again, and made as though she would have begged him to proceed, but said nothing. I am sensible that I speak to you at a disadvantage, dear Miss Airedale. Believe me that I am not so forgetful of the feelings of my younger days as not to know that you are little disposed to view me with favor. You have heard me described as cold-hearted, calculating, selfish.
I have never, sir, she interposed with an altered manner and a firmer voice. I have never heard you spoken of in harsher, disrespectful terms. You do a great wrong to Edward's nature if you believe him capable of any mean or base proceeding.
Pardon me, my sweet young lady, but your uncle nor is it my uncle's nature either, she replied, with a heightened color in her cheek. It is not his nature to stab in the dark, nor is it mine to love such deeds.
She rose as she spoke, and would have left him, but he detained her with a gentle hand, and besought her in such persuasive accents, to hear him but another minute, that she was easily prevailed upon to comply, and so sat down again.
And it is, said Mr. Chester, looking upward, and apostrophizing the air, it is this frank, ingenuous, noble nature, Ned, that you can wound so lightly. Shame, shame upon you, boy.
She turned towards him quickly, and with a scornful look and flashing eyes. There were tears in Mr. Chester's eyes, but he dashed them hurriedly away, as though unwilling that his weakness should be known, and regarded her with mingled admiration and compassion.
I never until now, he said, believed that the frivolous actions.
Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.